The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today is sentencing day for Brandon Strock, the founder of the Walkaway Movement. This is in connection with his activities on January 6th. And I'm going to talk about how the ordeal of Brandon Strock, whom I know, reveals the insidiousness of the January 6th prosecutions. There's a new twist in the Whitmer kidnapping case, and if anything, it puts the FBI in a worse light. I'll explain. How to account for the vilification of Sinema and Manchin. They're taking a position on the filibuster that was the same position that Obama and Biden and the Democrats took when Republicans were in power. But I'll give you two reasons why these have become two of the most hated figures in Washington. And I'll conclude my discussion of Pushkin's Eugene Onegin by describing, of all things, a duel. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Today is sentencing day for Brandon Strock, the founder of the Walkaway Movement. This is a very important movement that has been a sort of vehicle for a lot of Democrats and leftists to move right, to move to the Republican Party, to become conservatives. And Strock is a young, dynamic, kind of a charismatic guy, quite a character. A few years ago, I took part in an event with him that he sponsored in Portland, kind of a walkaway event. And Antifa showed up. And the Antifa guys, I think, brought their sticks, and I think they thought they would cause trouble. They had already vandalized the venue, tried to break the lock and so on. But, of course, this event had plenty of security, had armed guards. And once the Antifa guys saw the guns, you know, they had sticks, the security people had guns, they basically decided to quit, and they began to sulk and scowl. And one guy took out a flute and began to play it. The whole thing had a surreal quality, but I remember it vividly. Now, government's sentencing recommendation. Now, Brandon Strock pleaded guilty to causing a disturbance, something that he actually didn't even do. But we're going to get to what he actually did. But the government wants to sentence him to 4 months of house arrest. So kind of, in effect, lock him up in his own house with an ankle monitor and so on. 3 years of probation, 60 hours of community service, and $500 of restitution. And now, when you think about this recommendation, it doesn't seem in of itself something unendurable. In fact, Brandon Strock called me a few days ago, and he's like, what do you think about this? And I go, well, the sentence itself is stupid. Obviously, it's not a crime. It's not a grievous suffering to be confined to your own home. I go, you can be very effective. What really was worrying Brandon the most was the fact that the left, and here I'm thinking of an article in Political magazine that Brandon alerted me to, Trump ally Strock has provided potentially significant information. And if you read the article, it looks like prosecutors are giving Brandon Strock a good deal, a kind of a light sentence, because he has sort of spilled the beans. He has sort of ratted out Trump. He's ratted out other conservatives. Now, this is nothing could be further from the truth. The so-called ratting out, well, Politico doesn't even know what the ratting out is, but they darkly imply that Strock is a kind of sellout to the conservative cause. But in fact, Brandon explained to me, he goes, listen, what this has to do with is the government had accused me originally of trying to grab a shield from a cop. Now, this would actually put Brandon's offense in a little different category. It would be a violent action. Brandon would be sort of scuffling with a cop, trying to grab his shield. And Brandon said that when you look at the video, it's very obvious that he isn't doing it. Someone else is grabbing the shield. And Brandon said, I did my own research and I found out who it was. And I told the prosecutors, this is the guy, it's not me. And this was the, quote, new information. This was me cooperating with prosecutors to do what? Merely to identify the actual perpetrator of this violent act. Now, the prosecutors backed off, and in their description of Brandon's misdeeds, they now note that do not claim that he tried to grab the shield. They say that somebody else was yelling, take it, take it. And Brandon evidently repeated, perhaps just because he heard it, the phrase in a low voice, take it, take it. He heard someone else say that. He repeated that. That is the sole, quote, interaction that Brandon had with the shield. He didn't, in fact, do anything with it. And now the government says that he, quote, did nothing to discourage the rioters from removing the shield. So he's now being faulted with inaction, not something he did, but what he failed to do. He didn't stop them. Now, in order to prove that Brandon was sort of instigating or somehow cooperating with the violence, remember, Brandon Strock did not enter the Capitol. Recently, when Adam Kinzinger tweeted, no wonder they haven't arrested Ray Epps. Ray Epps didn't break the law. He didn't enter the Capitol. There are a number of people, the cowboy for Trump, Brandon Strock, who were arrested even though they did not set one foot into the Capitol. Nevertheless, the government tries to use Brandon's words from his social media posts to show that he was somehow participating or instigating violence. At one point, Strock says, quote, patriots at the Capitol, hold the line. Hold the line. But this is not unambiguously a call to violence at all. It's nothing more than, listen, don't give up. Hang tough. I mean, remember, all the people who came to Washington came to hold the line, came ultimately to stand up for their beliefs and their beliefs about the election. At another point, they quote Brandon Strock saying, quote, our government no longer listens and takes instructions from the people. They've decided to become dictators to the people. It's time to rise up. Whoop-dee-doo. This is boilerplate political rhetoric. There's nothing violent about it. It's not an instigation to violence. It was uttered 1 month before January 6th, could hardly be called something that was causing a kind of imminent call to action. So again, Brandon Strock did not enter the Capitol, did not engage in any violence, does not possess any weapons, accepted responsibility for what he did, and submitted to three separate government interviews. You've got to sort of contrast Brandon's conduct. If you want to put it in perspective, here's Kamala Harris in the thrust of the Black Lives Matter arson and looting and rioting. Here's Kamala Harris. They're not going to stop. And everyone beware, because they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop before Election Day, and they're not going to stop after Election Day. Everyone should take note of that on both levels. They're not going to stop, and they should not, and we should not. So talk about an endorsement of violent action in a direct manner by the current Vice President of the United States. And finally, we come to the government's most pathetic claim that somehow Brandon Strock is responsible for the entire actions of everyone there. Because, quote, if he didn't do what they did, what he did, they wouldn't do what they did. So this is a kind of sly attempt to sort of take other people's actions, in some cases violent actions, and transplant them onto Brandon Strock. He was part of this group, and, quote, the group did this, and the group did that. But Brandon's lawyers, I think very sensibly in the sentencing memo, say, listen, the defendant is not responsible for what other people did. The defendant is responsible, at least in a free society, for what he did. And his penalty, if anything, should be proportionate to what he did. As far as I can figure out, what Brandon Strock did was absolutely nothing. The guy deserves no penalty whatsoever. Obviously, he will get some penalty, but I hope the judge is smart enough to see that these are bogus charges. This is basically a bunch of nonsense. And no, Brandon Strock did not sell out the conservative movement. I'm still kind of seething and outraged over the debanking of Mike Lindell, because what does it mean in a country where you can't go open an account or keep an account in a bank when you're following the rules? It's outrageous. And I want to do what I can to support Mike Lindell. I have been. I want to continue to do that. And I want you to do so as well. Now, the good thing about Lindell is he makes great products, and he's got a ton of them. We're not talking about just the pillows or just the new My Slippers. They're great, but I love the pajamas. There's also the robes. My stepdaughter, Juliana, loves the dog bed. So it's time to go to his website or call the number and just go nuts. And great discounts, by the way. Great discounts if you use promo code Dinesh, up to 66%. Call 800-876-0227. Go to MyPillow.com. Use promo code Dinesh to take advantage of Mike's special offers on all the different products. Again, that number, 800-876-0227. Or go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. There's a remarkable new development in the Governor Whitmer kidnapping case. And I'm picking this up from the indispensable reporting of who else, Julie Kelly. If it wasn't for Julie Kelly, by the way, we wouldn't know about any of this. The Whitmer case is not being reported on in the media. And when I describe what's going on, you'll see why. Because there's the potential here for completely showing the FBI's involvement in instigating, orchestrating, planning, carrying out the plot. This is a case where the plot would not have gone forward without FBI involvement and massive FBI involvement, sort of one FBI agent for every so-called kidnapper. Now, the defense in the Whitmer kidnapping case has made a remarkable request, a request that's almost unheard of in this kind of a case. They've basically asked the government to give, and the judge, to give immunity to all the FBI agents involved. Wow, this may seem at first to be counterintuitive, to be preposterous. Shouldn't they be asking for immunity or some sort of immunity for their own clients? No, they're not asking for immunity for their clients. They're asking for immunity for the FBI agents. Now, let's think about why they would do that. Because, as I mentioned, a number of attorneys are actually quoted in Julie's article saying, you know, this is actually a very odd tactic. Why are you trying to exonerate what would be the government's witnesses, the government's agents? Well, the answer is simply this. The government's agents are being taken off the prosecutor's witness list. The government doesn't want its FBI agents to come forward. Why? Because they're going to be unmasked for their role in what they did in the plot. So the government's like, we just won't have them testify. So let's look at who's not testifying. Stephen Robeson, a convicted felon, was actually the guy who was probably most involved in planning this. He was on the government's list to testify. They've taken him off. This guy, Richard Trask, a key government agent, key FBI agent involved in this, an FBI operative and informant. And this is a guy who then mercilessly beat up his wife. He's under separate charges and separate criminal jeopardy, and the FBI takes him off the list. And so a dozen or so FBI agents are involved in orchestrating this kidnapping scheme, and prosecutors are desperate to conceal that. So their idea is, if we don't even have these FBI agents testify, nobody can ask them, what did you do? What was your role? Because they aren't testifying after all. So this is why the defense is like, listen, the most important thing here is to bust the scheme, to expose this as a government-instigated and a government-operated plot. And in order to do that, we need these FBI agents to spill the beans. Now, even the remaining FBI agents, since they are facing some jeopardy for what they did, they could take the fifth. They can say, look, I refuse to testify because it may incriminate me. And if you give them immunity, they'll have no reason to do that. So the point of giving them immunity is to make them testify and bring out from them the actual truth about what they did. So isn't this ironic that this is a case where the government here being the Biden administration, the U.S. attorney, these are guys who are trying to hide the truth. They're trying to prevent the full extent of FBI involvement from coming out. Now, it is worth noting that this guy, Stephen D'Antonio, who was running the Detroit FBI office, who kind of orchestrated the FBI's role in this operation, is the same guy who was then transferred to Washington, D.C., and is now spearheading the January 6th prosecution. So it's almost like the guy scored big in busting a bogus plot that he was actually a part of, and his work is so commended in the kind of new FBI, the new woke FBI, the FBI that creates plots and then busts them, that this guy is now on January 6th. So the reason the media is not covering it is that they know there are close connections between what happened in the Whitmer kidnapping plot and January 6th. The same groups, by the way, the Oath Keepers, the 3%ers, the Proud Boys, are involved again in both cases. And so they want to kind of leave their fingerprints off of that one. And they don't want people to be making any kinds of connections. So the defense memo says, quote, that if they can get Robeson to testify, get these other agents to testify, this will, quote, establish repeated violations of FBI policy and will be exculpatory for the defense. This is key. It seems in retrospect that this Whitmer kidnapping incident was a dress rehearsal for January 6th. That's why I'm focusing on it. That's why Julie is on it. And this is why the media is off it. This is why they don't want to cover it. Now, the trial is scheduled for, I believe, March 8th. And it's going to be hard, I think, to completely ignore the trial itself. But the government is trying to lay the groundwork for not a revelation of what happened, but a concealment of what happened. But I think that it's quite evident that their case is in serious trouble, that the defense has, in a sense, become playing offense at this point. And this has become a giant embarrassment for the Biden administration. So at this point, they're not even that eager to get those guys. What they're eager to do is make the whole thing go away and cover up the trail that seems to lead inexorably from the Whitmer kidnapping all the way to the U.S. Capitol. A third of Americans regularly suffer from nausea. My wife, Debbie, and I'm sort of chuckling because it seems like every time we talk about supplements and ailments, Debbie's like, she qualifies. She's right there. Yeah, anyway. She's been doing this one for a long time. She had a terrible time flying. But 15 years ago, she found this kind of miracle device that took away her nausea. And she's like, wow. Now she doesn't go on an airplane without it. She also gets a little vertigo. Now the Relief Band just makes it go away. It's just an incredible band. I'm talking about Relief Band. It's the number one FDA-cleared anti-nausea wristband. It's been clinically proven to quickly relieve and effectively prevent nausea and vomiting associated with motion sickness, anxiety, migraine, hangover, morning sickness, chemotherapy, and so much more. The technology was originally developed 20 years ago in hospitals, but now through Relief Band, it's available to you. Relief Band stimulates a nerve in the wrist that travels to the part of the brain that controls nausea. Then it blocks the signal your brain is sending to your stomach, telling you that you are sick. Relief Band makes a great gift for any time of the year. Right now, they've got an exclusive offer just for Dinesh D'Souza listeners. If you go to reliefband.com and use promo code Dinesh, you'll get 20% off plus free shipping and a no-questions-asked 30-day money-back guarantee. So head to reliefband.com. Use our promo code Dinesh for 20% off plus free shipping. The Democrats knew that they didn't have the votes on this voting rights law. They knew that they were going to lose, but they decided to make the play anyway, to, in a sense, call the roll, have the vote. And it went down, well, kind of just the way it was expected to go down. The Democrats lost. Voting rights bill is dead. Dead for now. Dead for this session. Went down 52-48. Sure enough, Manchin and Sinema voted with all 50 Republicans. And that was that. So before the vote, there was a sort of last-ditch, desperate attempt to try to arm twist or even pressure Manchin and Sinema. Here's a classic statement by Pramila Jayapal. Quote, if you don't think Mitch McConnell will get rid of the filibuster to push through his right-wing agenda, you haven't been paying attention. Actually, if you've been paying attention, you'd realize that Mitch McConnell had the opportunity to get rid of the filibuster. This was in the Trump years, and he didn't do it. In fact, he refused to do it. 37 Democratic senators demanded that he preserve the filibuster. Look at the hypocrisy of that. It's Mitch McConnell who's been consistent. He supported the filibuster all along. And I was reading this quote to Debbie this morning, and Debbie's laughing, and she goes, listen, what is Pramila Jayapal worried about? She goes, quote, our guys don't know how to play hardball like they do. We never do it. We're not as evil and cunning as they are. And then, of course, both of us said, well, maybe we should be. Maybe we could use one or two guys who are sort of snakes like Pelosi and Schumer. Where are snakes? You know, we seem to have all these kind of deer that play by the rules. But in this case, the good guys won, and it's very good. All the rhetoric about, you know, you're a segregationist, you're George Wallace, you're Jim Crow, you're trying to, you're allying yourself with Bull Connor. All of this stuff didn't go anywhere. Kristen Sinema, by the way, gave a kind of a tearful speech in which she said, and I think this really reflects her heartfelt conviction, quote, we have but one democracy. We can only survive, we can only keep it if we do so together. Now, I mean, I'm tempted to cheer this, but I think at the same time, a little critical reflection shows, is this really a naive hope? I mean, is the left right that this notion of being able to kind of get back together, put Humpty Dumpty back, is there a, can that, is that a realistic hope? Well, clearly cinema is expecting that. What I fear, however, is that there's been enough of a sort of secession of the American mind in which each side really thinks the other side is pulling down the guardrails. Each side thinks that the other side has sort of gone rogue, is not respecting the rules and parameters of basic constitutional democracy. And you have to go back, really, I think, to the 1850s to see this kind of mutual recrimination. Now, in reality, I think it's pretty obvious that one side, not both sides, but one side, is in fact pulling down the guardrails. I mean, ask yourself this. What guardrails have Republicans pulled down? People say, Republicans are trying to prevent important changes to voting rights. Well, let's think about it. Republicans are trying to have the same voting rights that we had when Obama was elected, when Obama was reelected, when Clinton was elected, when Clinton was reelected. So are you saying that America was a segregationist society in the 1990s, in 2008, in 2012? Obviously not. So it's the Democrats that have become radicalized, and they are seeing normal American politics of just a few years ago as somehow akin to the bad old days of the 1920s and 30s, if not the 1820s and 1830s. Now, Manchin, who's a different guy than Sinema, gave a very interesting speech where he talked about, he quoted James Madison, who said, quote, "The purpose of the Senate was to protect the people against their rulers, and secondly, to protect the people against the transient impressions into which they themselves may be led." These are quite profound statements, and I want to parse them out a little bit. Protect the people against the rulers. So the idea here is that you're protecting the people, the general welfare of the society, even against the elected representatives of those same people. There's no reason to believe that the representatives chosen by the people will always have fidelity to those people. And so, isn't it remarkable that here, you know, the Democrats assume, well, these people are elected, this is democracy in action. Well, Madison realized that it's not so simple. Human motives are corrupt enough that you got to protect the people from their own chosen leaders. And second, to protect the people against the transient impressions into which they themselves may be led. Wow, protect the people from themselves. The idea here is that democracy is a reflection of the considered judgment of the people, of people in their thoughtful mode, in the people after they've sort of had a conversation. Democracy is not mob rule. And even if the people themselves say, let's go get that guy, let's throw out this rule, the people may be hot-headed, they may be short-sighted. They have to be protected from their own hot-headedness, their own short-sightedness. So this Manchin, it seems, is doing some real thinking, quite apart from, I mean, obviously he's representing his own constituency. He's representing conservatives in a state that Trump won decisively. But I think more important than that, he's doing the statesmanlike task of examining not just the history of the filibuster, but the reason for the filibuster. And this is why these two guys, Manchin and Sinema, despite enormous pressure, you got to have some respect for their political courage. It's actually rare it's rare to see these days. And they exercised it, they delivered the goods, and as a result, this corrupt voting rights scheme to federalize elections and give Democrats a permanent advantage is now exactly where it belongs. In the grave. Inflation continues to gallop. I mean, it's 5%, then it's 6%, then 6.5%, now 7%. It looks like it's here to stay, and it looks like it's here to rise. And the dirty secret is our government kind of wants it because inflation rates are higher than the interest on treasury bonds. So with every day that passes, the government, in effect, owes less on its mountain of debt. Imagine if your mortgage had a negative interest rate. Well, you wouldn't be in any hurry to pay it off, would you? So your pain is their gain. And this is the point. Protect your savings now. Hedge against inflation with gold from Birch Gold because the government is sabotaging the value of the dollar. Birch Gold will help you convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by real gold. Now, that's peace of mind. That's why I'm a customer. And Birch Gold has thousands of satisfied customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. You can trust Birch Gold to protect your savings. Text Dinesh to 989898. You'll get a free information kit on holding gold in a tax-sheltered account. Then call Birch Gold, figure out how you can protect your hard-earned savings. Again, text Dinesh to 989898 to get your free information kit now. Guys, I'm really delighted to welcome to the podcast a friend of mine, Robert Agostinelli, Robert is the co-founder of Roan, an investment firm with offices in New York and London. Before that, he was at Lazard Frères. He was at Goldman Sachs. He is a great guy and a conservative. And Robert, welcome to the podcast. Delighted to have
Good
you. I still fondly remember that you called me one day out of the blue and said, let's go to Gettysburg. And I forget if we took my plane or yours. No, I'm kidding. We took your plane. But it was, I'd never been to Gettysburg. And not only was it an adventure and wonderful to be there, but I mean, you cracked me up with one anecdote after another. My favorite, by the way, which I want you to tell, is how you had a role, even if a small role, in actually selecting the French cabinet. In other words, you were on the plane with Nicolas Sarkozy, who had just been elected. Say what happened.
Right. So he had just been elected the night before, and we flew secretly to escape for two or three days before the inauguration down to Malta to get on Vincent Bolloré's yacht, which was, a big yacht. And on that flight was the nuclear codes. And on that flight was the colonel with the nuclear codes. And there was his wife and I and a couple other people. And they sat down at the back table and opened up the papers and said, okay, we have to choose the section de cabinet. And so I sat with the two of them, and I had the most powerful time of my life. I said, oh, that guy, he doesn't make any sense.
Veto that guy.
That's
fantastic. Well, Robert, you have written a very powerful and, to me, moving article about your high school. This is Aquinas Institute in Rochester, New York. In a way, a famous high school. And you were a student there, but you also got to know the famous Roman Catholic Bishop Fulton Sheen. I didn't know that you were an altar boy serving in Mass with Fulton Sheen. This is amazing. And you had, it seems, a wonderful experience. You say a formative experience at Aquinas Institute. And then years later, now that you're a big shot, you're a tycoon, I guess the Aquinas Institute decided we can get some coins out of Robert. Let's invite him and his family back. Tell what happened.
That's exactly what happened. They've been soliciting me for some years now. And I had a sense, the echo chamber suggested that not all was good in Mudville. And I thought carefully about going up there. I was going to see my aunts and uncles because they're quite old. And I tied the two together and I said to them, I'm happy to talk to the students, take a tour. They got red carpet was rolled out for me, my wife. But I prepared diligently, to talk to those students, which I found out afterward were hand-selected by them. There were about 100 to 150 people there, the students that I gauged, more the senior classes, junior and senior classes. And I borrowed, which I told everybody, the concept of my talk on a one that Sheen had given me in 1967, which I understood after I studied it, he'd actually given Dinesh in 1947 on the radio. And the concept was on hell and the Iron Curtain. And it played right in on steroids to where we are today. Basically, that speech revolved around the concept of the egocentric maniac and the fact that maniac, which is the altered self of the individual, sitting in the center of Dante's universe, and the torture that happens within the individual when the devil enters the self and rejects, hates himself, hates his neighbor unless the neighbor completely endorses him, and hates God. And how you correct that is why, as you know, Christian faith, God is in Christianity, God comes down to man, and man has the opportunity in Christianity, opens up his heart. And I urge those students to open their heart. And I told them to. They did not have to support or accept the false deities that were being imposed on most of our nation today. And I named them gender critical race theory, gender confusion, the LGBT movement, and all the rest, and the Black Lives Matter, dedicated Marxist organization to our destruction. I listed them in that fashion. I said, these are illustrative of what I say is the issue. And that they have a right to the to be entitled, something that you've always said to me and to all of your fans and listeners, they have a right to their access to the American dream, just like I had, just like you had. And they, but there was the battle of their generation, not mine. And they had to stand up for what was the truth, the word of God, their trident faith, et cetera.
I mean, Robert, you're would you not say, an embodiment of that American dream? You grew up in modest, I assume, middle-class circumstances in Rochester. You studied hard. You went to good schools. You made a huge success of yourself. You're now a cosmopolitan figure living part-time or nearly full-time in Europe. You're back and forth. So in a sense, you are someone who knew what you were speaking about. You've lived it. And you communicated, it seems, this experience, but along with this deeper sort of spiritual insight. Now, describe the reaction.
Well, the react. My wife also spoke, and she spoke. She's very active, you know, in women's women, and she spoke about the distinction between femininity and feminism, the latter being evil, essentially, and against the Catholic faith. It always gets homogenized and scrubbed, but the truth is, it's not true. And after the talk, there was a rousing applause. There was a Q&A. Three students, when I mentioned the various false deities, three students who seemed to be sitting together, I noticed together, got up and walked out. My day, if you'd done that, you'd have been given a detention. I suggested they must be running to class, although I also mentioned I didn't think so. But the rest of the students, it was emotional, Dinesh. They embraced it. They were up on the stage afterwards, surrounding my wife and myself. They're many in tears, saying it was the most important talk they had had in their time at Aquinas. Quote, you don't know how necessary this is, and you don't know the battle for the soul of the school that's going on. This is so striking stuff going up there as being touted as, you know, Mr. Arguably one of the most successful guys that had gone to the school. And it had repercussion way beyond what I intended, and what I opened up Pandora's box. That's basically what happened.
Now, interestingly,
it was a rousing success with the kids.
Now that happens, and that would have been that, and you would have probably have gone home, and you would have said, "Listen, you know, there were a couple of malcontents. Not everybody's going to agree, but thank God the majority of the students were behind me." But that's actually not the last chapter of this. What happened is that somehow the administration, the head of school, sprang into action, and this, I think, is depressingly predictable denouement, conclusion of this. Say what happened when the administration decided to send out one of their inevitable community-wide letters.
I went off to I was invited because the football coach came by. He actually went to school with me. That was an emotional reunion. I hadn't seen him in years, and I was invited to be brought in by car privately to the football game that night. I played football there. Special guest on the field, you know, give a John Madden wave to everybody. And I didn't know if I could do it, but I said, that's really kind. I'll try to come back. And I went off to another college where I'd gone, St. John College, St. John Fisher College, to talk to some of the graduate students there. And I ran out of time, and I just wrote the school and said, I'm sorry, I can't make it. Next morning, I wake up at the hotel. I look at my emails, and I see this email from someone I've never heard of, who turned out to be a parent of two students at the school, sending a very articulate letter of complaint to the head of the administration of the school, Anthony Cook, saying, how dare you insult this man and his family who came here and gave such a tremendous message to the kids? And I don't know what he's talking about. I scroll down, and there is this, as you say, the missive to from the Politburo to the masses, declaring me wantonly out of line with the quote, the values and beliefs of the administration, faculty of the school. And later on, I read another email where he had disinvited me on, you know, spurious technical grounds that nobody was going to be allowed. No private people were allowed at the match on the field, and that hope you have a good trip. So he didn't come right out and say what he'd done. He didn't announce to me. He sent out this missive. I found out by this third party email that I received. And that's when I sprang in.
And I mean, as always in the missive, it concludes, and this made me almost chuckle out loud. we will be providing counseling for students who have been traumatized by Mr. Agostinelli. Evidently, you had such an emotional impact that these students were gasping and apparently in need of psychiatric care.
It is sick. It's diabolical and sick. I'll tell you, Bishop Sheen, I'm sure that it was the hand of Sheen that guided me there. I'm sure it's the hand of Bishop Sheen who guided me, and probably my now sainted son Stefano, who put me in the line to dig out those papers and recast it as a message of today. But if Sheen were alive today and something like that would have happened, God help him. That's all I got to say.
You know what, Robert, we have to do this again. And what I want to talk to you about when you come back is talk a little bit about how we fight this kind of thing. Because as I think you know, this is endemic. This is not particular to one school or the other. You just experienced it firsthand. But for now, thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for sharing. This has been, wow, most enlightening.
And the parents, Dinesh, who are all big fans of yours, we have almost 400 parents and alumni who signed on to a petition that is going to demand, at your point, I will talk more about it, but Betsy DeVos is going to be involved. We are going to go after these people. It stops now.
Awesome. Thanks, Robert Agostinelli. Great to see you again.
God bless you, Dinesh. Thanks.
You know, one thing you can say about pain, it's a pain. And you don't have to live with it. I mean, aches and pains are something we all get. We think it's, well, a normal wear and tear of time or injury. But what's different now is that there's a solution. It's a 100% drug-free solution. It's called Relief Factor. Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. And it's inflammation that's the source of aches and pains. Now, experience shows the vast majority of people who try Relief Factor order more. They stay as customers. Why? Because they know that it works. It works for them. Debbie's a true believer. She's had this frozen shoulder. But Relief Factor has been a complete game changer in relieving the pain. And Debbie knows if she doesn't take it, regularly the pain is going to return. So she's made a vow. I'm never going to be without this again. Well, being able to exercise, lift her arm, this is all super important to her. Relief Factor is the tool she needs. You too can benefit. So go ahead, try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That number again, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. You'll feel the difference. The Davos World Economic Forum has been in full swing, and we're getting periodic reports about what has sometimes been called the Great Reset. Now, there is a little bit of paranoia about the Great Reset. It's as if these Davos guys are trying to somehow, you know, take over the world and run it in a completely totalitarian fashion, make property rights disappear, and establish a single global currency. I don't think that is entirely right. But I do think that Davos represents an attempt, in fact, they say this explicitly, to use the COVID epidemic to transform global arrangements. Now, a little bit of an autobiographical note. I was at Davos myself. I was invited to Davos many years ago, maybe 20 years ago, maybe even longer, to do a debate on Western civilization. And I met Klaus Schwab. He was a younger Klaus Schwab then. I met Bill Gates. I met Yasser Arafat. In fact, I was at a small dinner with Arafat and like 10 other people. And I participated in this debate. It was Shimon Peres, the former prime minister of Israel, and me, and we were against two other guys, Wole Soyinka, a Nobel laureate from Africa, and also a political scientist named Benjamin Barber. Essentially, it was like, is Western civilization had a good or bad influence on the world? I mean, it's pretty obvious considering the whole world is moving as embrace Western technology, Western institutions, India being a classic example. But nevertheless, they thought this would be a lively subject for a debate. It was really fun. I mean, there was the Queen of Norway sitting in the front row and came up to me afterward and said how great I was. I mean, it's kind of funny when you're in that small group and you're on the ski slopes of Switzerland. You do get the illusion for about 5 minutes that you're, quote, running the world, even though you're running nothing. You're basically just running downhill. But you think, oh, man, you know what? What I say here is going to be transcribed. It's going to be there are going to be articles in Thailand and in Zambia and so on about it. So there's an easy receptivity to this kind of illusion But, you know, who opened the Davos conference this year? Well, Xi Jinping. So that's a little bit of a symbolism right there. Not to say, again, that the Davos people want to become like Xi. I'm not saying that they want to establish global dictatorship. But it is true that they, and Klaus Schwab himself was kind of blunt about this. He goes, the neoliberal era has gone out of fashion. And by neoliberal, what he means here is free trade, freedom, property rights, the idea of national interests and countries acting cooperatively, but nevertheless while each protecting their national interests, a kind of global order, but a global order based upon neoliberalism. And now the new slogans are things like global equity. Obviously, we hear a lot about climate change. What we hear about under COVID are these sort of coordinated restrictions and lockdowns. And so there's no question that there is a move, and that the Davos crowd is pushing this, a move towards centralization of power within countries, and then a little more centralization of power even on the global scale. Suddenly, national interest, which, by the way, the Chinese are very well aware of their national interests. They aggressively promote their national interests. They're better at it than we are. And yet, at the same time, Xi Jinping was very cunning. He steps up there and he goes, you know, this rising tide of nationalism is very disturbing. What he means is that your nationalism is very disturbing. Leave it. You guys should talk about cosmopolitanism. Why don't you let us worry about the nationalism? We've got that one down. So Davos is an exercise. If you want a window into the sort of global elites and their way of thinking, there's no question. They do have a tyrannical streak, and they do have an appetite for, we are the experts, we are in charge. This is why they love issues which rely on experts. I mean, health relies on experts. Climate relies on experts. You know, some guy with a thermometer, I've measured the ocean's temperature at both ends of the earth. They love that kind of stuff because it takes the ordinary guy out of it. Freedom has to be subordinate to some sort of medical judgment or some kind of expert judgment. Where is that judgment going to come from if not from the sort of apostles at Davos? So this is the Davos sensibility. I think we can be grateful this only happens once a year. All these windbags get together. Think of it as a kind of UN. I mean, the UN is a high-minded, pompous organization, but the real motive of the UN is for some guy to come from Singapore or to come from Burundi and eat in really nice New York restaurants and bloviate a lot and beat his foot on the, you know, his shoe on the table. So it's a society for doing that, and the best response to that is simply to chuckle and to ignore. Happy New Year, guys. 2022 is going to be a critical year for America and for AMAC. This is the Association of Mature American Citizens, along with their nearly 2 million members, like me and Debbie. Now, the fight to stop out-of-control spending and the president's Build Back Better scheme, it's far from over. Congress is plotting new legislation, more legislation that could hurt our seniors. And the midterm elections are going to be a big battle, freedom versus socialism. Now, unlike liberal groups, we know which those are, AMAC is America's conservative, action-oriented organization for people 50-plus fighting hard every day in Washington and across the nation for our seniors. Now, I'm urging you to choose AMAC now. You'll get all the great membership benefits, AMAC discounts on hotels, travel, restaurants, and your membership will support your values. So go to amac.us/Dinesh. That's amac.us/Dinesh and become an AMAC member now. I've talked about the Hispanic vote, and yesterday I talked a little bit about the Asian vote. And I want to talk today about the black vote. There's an interesting article by a guy named Darvio Moro. I don't know this guy, so the article I saw in Newsweek, and at the end it says that Darvio Moro is the CEO of the FCB radio network, co-host of the Outlaws radio show. But it's a thoughtful article, and it says that, look, blacks have been beholden to the Democratic Party. Every 2 years, every 4 years, the Democrats show up in our communities, he says. They scare us into voting for them. I'm not quoting him. And then after we do disappear and leave our communities in exactly the same condition they found them. So Democrats do this, and we know they do it, but interestingly, he says that blacks know that they do it. He describes the relationship between the Democrats and the blacks as, quote, abuse by neglect. So they're being abused, they're harvested for their votes, and then they're neglected. And so, says Mr. Morrow, there is, quote, a historic precedent for a realignment. Now, he points to the earlier realignment. Blacks used to be, of course, in the 19th century and early 20th century Republicans. Then they began to move over to the Democratic Party, really starting, not in the 60s, but with FDR. And then that trend accelerated in the 1960s. And certainly for the past half century, blacks have been loyal Democrats. Republicans have been lucky to get 10 or 15% of the black vote. But, says Morrow, quote, black discontent is now aimed at the left. Blacks know who's been running black communities, not Republicans. So it becomes increasingly abstract and somewhat absurd to conduct this theater in which you invoke the bad Republicans. What bad Republicans? The bad Republicans who freed the slaves? The bad Republicans who fought against lynching that was being supported by FDR? FDR was blocking anti-lynching laws. The Republicans who fought against the Democratic segregationists who were holding up voting rights legislation. So this is all fiction, but it's a fiction that's been developed in academia. It's promulgated through the media. But says Mr. Morrow, on critical issues, and he mentions really two, education and crime, but he also alludes to COVID extremism. He says that black interests are being subordinated to white progressive interests. So white progressives have come up with defund the police, which is basically a scheme for protecting black criminals. And he goes, the main effect of this is felt by black citizens, by law-abiding blacks who become victims of crime. And so he goes, violent crime is tearing our communities apart, and yet liberals continue to elect district attorneys who refuse to prosecute criminals. This is, as we know, the sort of Soros model. He says, when it comes to education, blacks know that that's the only path up. I mean, Asians have demonstrated that. Hispanics know that. Blacks know that, too, that school choice and these issues are the way for blacks. And it's not even so much a matter of, we shouldn't use the abstract language of vouchers. How about scholarships? A voucher is a scholarship. You're giving a scholarship to give an opportunity to a black kid who's in a terrible public school to now go to a private school or to go to a Catholic school or a Christian school and get a better education. And why can't the parents have that kind of power to make that decision? Now, says Morrow, the Republicans sort of are on the right path, but he goes, but they're not going into the black community and selling it. He goes, even Trump. He goes, Trump had a great plan. It was called the Platinum Plan. He goes, you probably haven't heard of it. Why? Because they didn't sell it. They didn't sell it to the country. They didn't sell it enough in the black community. It was basically a plan for creating 500,000 new black businesses, 3 million new jobs in the inner cities. So Trump was on this. He devised a plan to do it, but he didn't carry out taking that plan and sort of evangelizing for it and obviously harvesting the political capital that comes out of doing that, where blacks go, wow, this is amazing. Who thought of this? Well, the Republicans did. And so he goes, Republicans talk about today the white working class and even the Hispanic working class, but there's a black working class. And this black working class has a strong interest in law and order. It has a strong interest in education. It has a strong interest in upward mobility. So by and large, I think what's going on here is that there's a window of opportunity. Now, let's step back and introduce a note of realism. I do not think that anytime soon Republicans will get the black vote or the majority of the black vote or even a sizable minority of the black vote. But if Republicans could just increase their share of the black vote, in other words, don't go for 50%. You may not get 50%. That might be disillusioning, but go for 20%. Go for 25%. Make steady progress, you may say, up the ladder. Keep increasing your portion, if you will, of the pie of those votes. And look, if Republicans can get 50% of the Hispanic vote, 50% of the Asian vote, this should be easy to do with sound campaigning and 20% of the black vote. That would establish the Republicans in a very strong position and would create the possibility of having a more lasting Republican imprint, not just on policy, but on the culture and on the country. Today I'm going to conclude my discussion of the great poet Alexander Pushkin and his masterpiece called Eugene Onegin. Now, Pushkin is the kind of national poet or literary figure of Russia. He has the same position in Russian literature that, say, Shakespeare has, for example, in England, or that Goethe has in Germany, or Dante in Italy. And it's partly because Pushkin came early, but it's partly because he did so much. And he lived a very colorful life. He died at a very young age, 37, killed in a duel. And he was both at the same time a genius, but he was at the same time a kind of wastrel. By that I mean he was a gambler, and he was a drinker, and he was a womanizer, and he was reckless in all kinds of ways. In fact, on more than one occasion, he was close to getting involved in a duel, and eventually he did, and it killed him. When he was gambling, he would sometimes run out of money completely, and then they would say, "You got to put something on the table." And he'd be like, "Well, I've got my latest chapter of Eugene Onegin." And they're like, "Okay, put that on the table." And literally, he would lose his own chapter of his own poem. And then later, he would then borrow money and like buy it back. So this is a crazy Russian. Now, I talked a little bit about the romance, or if you can use that term, between Onegin and Tatiana. And that's the beginning and end of the story. But amazingly, there is a kind of middle plot that I want to focus on in completing my discussion of this work. And the middle plot involves the friendship between Onegin, who is a man of the world, a cosmopolitan, a cynic, not an entirely good guy by any means, and a young poet named Lenski. Now, this poet, Lenski, is a pure product of romanticism. You can almost see him as a kind of early Byronic figure. And in fact, this is a guy who studies in Göttingen, where Göttingen in Germany. And Pushkin describes him as a young, fiery-eyed Russian with long curls, as was the style of the day. And interestingly, these two very different characters, Lenski and Onegin, become close friends. And Onegin is a little older, and he sort of takes a cynical view of Lenski. Lenski actually falls head over heels in love with this young woman named Olga. And in fact, he brings all his romantic afflatus to this relationship. He's a man who wants to be in love, and his passions have descended on this young woman, Olga, and he's fanatical about her. And of course, Onegin is kind of like, well, I mean, geez, doesn't this guy realize love is an illusion? He takes this kind of sophisticated view, but he's like, but let him have it. It's an illusion that, you know, the young are entitled to. So he's indulgent toward his young friend, Lenski. Well, Lenski invites Onegin to what's called a name day celebration. In those days, the Russians in the countryside would celebrate the saint that you're named after. So if you're named after Peter, then Saint Peter would be your name day. You'd celebrate Saint Peter's Saint's Day as the name day celebration. So there's a name day celebration going on, and it's a very rustic, almost you would call it like a sort of an agricultural fair. And even though Onegin's reluctant to go, he does go with Lenski, his friend. But when he's there, he becomes extremely annoyed because here he is, this cosmopolitan kind of city character, and he's in among these bumpkins, and he's like, they've got nothing to say to me. I've got nothing to say to them. And then some of the bumpkins spot him, and they realize he's kind of a misfit, so they start making fun of Onegin, and he overhears them, and he becomes extremely angry, and he blames his friend Lenski. And so he goes, I'm going to teach Lenski a lesson. You here begin to see the kind of darker side of Onegin come out. He goes, you know what? I'm going to teach him a lesson he's not going to forget. And the way he does it, which is very bad, is when the dancing begins, in those days you'd have a dance card in which you would sign up sort of to dance with someone. Onegin signs up to dance all the dances of the whole evening with Olga. Everyone. And so there they are dancing away and chatting away. And of course, Onegin is getting kind of deliberately flirty. He's not genuinely flirting with her, but he's making a show of flirting with her. And of course, here is Lenski sitting by the side, kind of sulking. And finally, Lenski goes up to Olga and says, can I have a dance? And she goes, oh, no, you can't, because I'm all signed up with Onegin. And of course, Olga's innocent in the matter, but Lenski is furious at his friend. He sort of loses it, and he goes up to Onyegin, starts screaming at him, and so on. And Onyegin is like, don't make a scene, you know, kind of let's discuss this later, and so on. But Lenski is out of control. He's a creature of passion, and he's outraged, and his feelings are hurt. And so he lets Onyegin have it, and at the end of it, and this is, of course, the point at which things become sort of dangerous, he throws down the glove and challenges Onyegin to a duel. Now, Onyegin, at this point, he's smart enough to realize, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. He's like, he says to himself, hey, Onyegin, you know, you're a man of the world. How could you get yourself in such a ridiculous situation? You are being challenged to a duel by your own best friend. You had no intention of getting into a fight, let alone a fight to the end. And yet, so Onyegin realizes that he's done something utterly unforgivable. And yet, in the code of honor of the day, what do? You can't refuse a duel. So Onyegin sort of summons up his outrage and goes, I'll teach you a lesson, you young punk, and so on. And Lenski is like, no, I'll teach you a lesson. And so the duel is on. It's on. Well, the next morning, Lenski is up at dawn, gets up at 6 in the morning. And in fact, he goes, let's go, we're late. Onyegin will not want to wait. So Lenski is like, he wants to be on time. He wants to get it over with. He wants to teach Onyegin a lesson. But where's Onyegin? He's fast asleep. He doesn't take the whole thing seriously. He sleeps for hours while Lenski is waiting. And while Lenski is waiting, he utters a beautiful poem. A poem that has been sort of immortalized, not only in Pushkin, but in Tchaikovsky, and Tchaikovsky's opera about Eugene Onyegin. And in Tchaikovsky's words, one of the most famous arias in Russian opera, you have Lenski go, where, oh, where are the golden days of our youth? And essentially, Lenski is saying, look, this might be my last day. And if it's my last day, then will Olga, the woman he loves, whom he calls her husband, whom he calls, he says he is her husband, he says, will she even remember me when I'm in my, if and when I'm in my grave? So beautifully rendered by Tchaikovsky, very famous in Russia, famous in the Pushkin passage as well. And but eventually Pushkin shows up, the duel is on, and, well, what do you know, Onyegin shoots Lenski dead. And, of course, the moment he does that, he is absolutely horrified. He's killed his own best friend. And I think what's particularly powerful here is that, and I don't even know if this is really intentional, I don't think it is, but if you really think about what's going on here, is that if you think about Lenski the poet, think about it, you have a poet, Pushkin, writing about a poet, Lenski. So obviously that's a part of Pushkin. Pushkin will have identified with the poet in Lenski. Why? Because that's the poetic side of Pushkin. Well, what's the other side of Pushkin? Well, it's the Onyegin side. It's the gambler. It's the wastrel. It's the adulterer. It's the jackass. It's the jerk. And Pushkin was really all of those things. So here you have almost a beautiful metaphor for how, just as in Eugene Onyegin in the story, Lenski is shot dead by Onyegin. This is also what happened to Pushkin. In other words, one could say that at the end of his life, and it was a short life, in his late 30s, the Onyegin part of Pushkin assassinated the Lenski part of Pushkin. Basically, what happened is that Pushkin was having his way with all these men's wives. And finally, one guy, this was actually a French emigre officer, decided, well, two people can play at this game. So he began to sort of court Pushkin's wife. Well, what does Pushkin do? Challenges him to a duel. And Pushkin shoots, hits the guy, but hits him, the guy's wearing a military uniform, and it hits him on the button of the uniform, injuring the other guy but not killing him. The other guy fires at Pushkin, doesn't kill him immediately, but seriously wounds him. Pushkin is taken to a hospital where he lives for several days, but ultimately they're unable to restore him, and Pushkin dies in a hospital bed. So here we have, in a way, again, that I'm not sure Pushkin fully intended, a almost precursor in Eugene Onyegin of the tragic end of Russia's greatest poet, Alexander Pushkin.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.
Three, three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.